Welcome to podcast number 7. Now, you're not seeing things. I haven't published podcast number 6 yet because that's going to be the end of the book, just a general summary. I thought I'd go on to looking at the characters. So that's what this podcast is actually going to be about. I'll start off with Anna and then go to Eleanor and Michael. And I'm going over some insight notes that came as part of a handout to the class. I'm going to be summarising the notes that my students have generated. And at the end, I've got a few new ones that I'll throw in and just sort of generally link into the themes as well of what's going on in the book. Okay, so we'll start with Anna. Now, you know that she's a first-person narrator, that she's the heroine, the protagonist of Year of Wonders. What you want to remember when you're writing your SAC or your exam response to this text is that it's a really pedantic, fairly boring summary if you just talk about the fact that she changed over the course of the novel. It's self-explanatory in a sense, so what you want to do when you're discussing Anna is trying to look at the things that made her change and why she chose to, because she didn't need to change. She could have just rejected Eleanor's teaching. She could have picked up and had a life with Michael if she wanted to. So you want to be looking for things that actually make her change, okay? Now, there are the events that are explored and presented in Year of Wonders actually come through Anna's eyes. So it's a very subjective viewpoint. You want to keep that in mind. Her interpretations of how people behave, how things kind of evolve in the village of Eme are presented subjectively through her. The fact that she had a violent upbringing has left her scarred, and she isn't a confrontational person, but she is somebody that has been sufficiently beaten both physically on a literal level and also on a figurative level, beaten down. And so she, part of the evolution of Anna as a character actually happens as a result of her finding her own voice and her own place and discovery of a sense of self. And her worth. Now, she's married off to Sam at 15. Her father and stepmother, Aphra, decide that it's probably time to marry her off. And at one point, Aphra actually tells Joss not to hit her in the face because that will mean that she won't be able to be married, which is just horrific in its own quiet little way. Her marriage to Sam at 15 gives her a sense of stability for the first time in her life. So when he dies 3 years later in a mining accident. She's left with two small children, like really small children. And so she's your age, essentially. She is your age. She's a widow, two small children, trying to make ends meet. Now, George Vickers presents himself both initially from a financial point of view as a saviour, and later on presents her with the sense that she could have a life of stability with him as well. He dies, obviously, as the first plague victim in Eme. And remember, Eleanor describes the plague as a starburst that kind of spread out from Anna's cottage. So one of the things that kind of struck me when I was reading this book was the fact that nobody actually ever really turns around to Anna and blames her. Because the plague actually originates at her cottage, but no one ever blames her. And no one ever kind of blames George Vickers either. They blame the Gowdies, they blame each other, but they never kind of visit that vengeance on Anna as such. Now, her transformation is described as the one good perhaps to come out of this terrible year, and that's on page 235. Eleanor acts as her teacher and the guide, Anna's guide, and the learning curve that she kind of goes through during the course of this novel. She has an innate, so that means that she's got a very built-in sense of courage and justice and compassion. It's not, she's not a saint. She's not someone that is, a goody-two-shoes. She is somebody that learns the true meanings of these qualities over the course of the novel, because she gets the opportunity to actually put them into action. And one of the redeeming features of Anna as a character is that she doesn't exploit the situation for her own gain. There is a hint of that with the opium in the poppies of Leith, but she's the polar opposite of her father. Her sense of standing up for herself. So do you remember when I was saying a little bit earlier about the whole idea of her, part of the journey of Anna as a character is that she realises her own sense of worth. Her sense of standing up for herself and that sense of worth also comes to the fore when her father is punished. After the Christopher Unwin incident where he was actually burying Unwin alive and taking stuff from his cottage, Anna refuses to say anything at the miners' tavern when her father's being judged. And it's different at this point than her earlier humiliation at the tavern because she knows that the punishment is going to be forthcoming. Like, she doesn't know that Joss is going to die up there. She makes the assumption that Aphra will go and free him. So she is prepared to accept the punishment, whereas before she gives in to her father. So there's a very different sense of the woman that she is becoming by this point in the novel. For her, when she refuses to say anything in defence of her father, it's clear that justice is more important than her as a person. She is learning to stand up for something bigger than she herself. And when he dies, she reminds herself that actually she suffered terribly at the hands of Joss, who was a bully and just sadistic, actually. And her guilt that she feels at letting him die lessens. By the end of the novel, she realises that if she stays in England, she's going to be forever a subject to that patriarchal society that pretty much has ruled her life up to this point. She's had domineering males, apart from Sam. Sam was probably the exception. And I think George Vickers was in the same vein as Sam, someone that was content to let Anna be who she was, but we don't really know how deep that actually went and what he really thought, like how much he would actually, how much leeway he would really allow Anna because he dies too quickly. Her conscious decision to reject Michael at the end of the book, especially after she learns of what he did to Eleanor, shows that she's unafraid for the first time, and she's someone that is willing to take her own destiny in her own hands as opposed to letting the men around her kind of control it. Interestingly enough, she recognises that the force of Michael's will is something that he will not or cannot change and that she doesn't actually want to be subject to this herself. She has by now enough self-respect to take heart from her own courage and to follow her instincts. So she's quite a modern woman. If you look at the feminist movement and what women of the 20th century were kind of arguing for, she's very modern in that respect. She shows courage again, so she's kind of exercising the demonstration of courage when she adopts the Bradford baby and putting the wellness and the safety of this child before her own is really courageous as well. And sort of, again, something bigger than she is. The contrast, when she gets to Oman from England, are stark. So Bay, who she marries, allows her to be the best version of herself. Whilst if she'd remained in England, she would have been constricted by social obligations and expectations. There's an element of uncertainty as to how far and how long this would be allowed to be tolerated for. The fact that we've agreed that hope, as opposed to faith, would be enough for now. The fact that she puts the "for now" at the end of it gives me indication that perhaps this is a transitional stage for her, and also the fact that she might be freer whilst living in this harem in Oman. She might be freer in terms of being able to study and learn and practice medicine. But the women of Oman don't necessarily seem to be freer than the women in England, because she recounts the whole idea of women not talking to male doctors because they were afraid, they were embarrassed, it wasn't the done thing. And so there was a lot of suffering that women in the country underwent as a result of this. just going back slightly, the measure of how much she recognises her obligations and herself as a woman comes a little bit earlier when she feels as though she's robbed Eleanor of her wedding night and the betrayal of her friend. And as one of my students said today, there is a girl code, and how could Anna actually go against this girl code and sleep with the husband of her dead best friend? And that's a fair point. You want to think about, why is it that Anna was selfish enough to kind of go there with Michael when she wasn't able to do that? Eleanor wasn't able to do that with her husband. So it's something you might want to think about with that too. Because Anna says, instead of taking my pleasure from his body, I'd stolen from her. Stolen what should have been hers, her wedding night. And that's something that Anna's going to have to live with. But she's also mature enough now. I think she's grown up enough in such a short amount of time that she's actually capable of accepting and living with the consequences of her guilt. Now, in terms of the student notes, when I got the students to work through and kind of collate notes on Anna, the fact that she defends the Gowdies, she works with Eleanor to replace them after their deaths, even though they're struggling with a limited amount of knowledge, it's, again, quite a courageous thing to do, because these women are taking on a risky strategy. The mob has already decimated the Gowdies in sort of true vigilante style. And so you've got Anna and Eleanor taking on not only a social risk, but also a medicinal risk as well. She's putting herself physically in danger to help these plague victims and to help with the childbirth of the local women. Even though she admits that she has nothing left to lose, the fact that she physically goes in and looks after people with the plague and all their weeping sores and their buboes and the smell of the rotting apples is something that kind of shows that, again, she's learning to put something bigger than herself first. She helps Mary Wickford to become independent, although she herself is emotionally distraught because Sam died in a cave-in. She puts aside her own fears, which shows that she's selfless and strong. And she also forces Eleanor out of the mine as well and tells her to go above ground. She will handle this. The technique that Anna actually uses to dislodge the lead is the same technique that actually killed Sam. She is a sympathetic protagonist who says in her own words that she was a timid girl who grows up to be a woman who had faced more terrors than many warriors. And it's kind of a dig at Bradford as well, given that he's a man who's renowned for leading men into battle. But as soon as he himself is threatened, packs the family up and takes off. And it's interesting to kind of look at the polar opposites of the reactions of the men and women there. And that would also be an opportunity to look at perhaps just widening it out slightly in terms of a wider context and how the nobility and the clergy and the medical profession were the first ones to kind of jump ship, as it were, as soon as the plague hit London and other major cities. She decides when to get on this cargo ship from Liverpool, showing immense bravery. She's going to an unknown land, doesn't know the language, doesn't know what kind of place in society she can expect to have. And it shows that she's becoming this independent woman, breaking social conventions of the time. And it's something that Anna's actually kind of foreshadowed earlier on in the book when she says, I think you like to go and come without a man say so. And Anna, at this point, early on in the novel, doesn't really see that. Like, she's not able to articulate it as such. So when Michael threatens to subtly dominate her life, right at the end when he gives her the note to Eleanor's father's estate, she decides that she's had enough, that it's time for a change, that she wants to be master of her own destiny for the first time in her life. And it's also a way of breaking that control that Michael has over her and rejecting his dominance that he had over Eleanor as well. So she's kind of making a stand for both women. Okay, now I know that we're already up to 15 minutes, given that I do love to chat. So what I will do is do a little break, and then we'll do Eleanor, and then we will get into, God help us, the Sermonator. Okay, so let's start with Eleanor now. And the friendship between the two women is something that's incredibly important to Anna, and she doesn't realize how much she has taken from Eleanor, probably until the end, when after Eleanor dies, she vows that she's going to think about how Eleanor would behave and what she would say and what kind of actions she would carry through with. So in a sense, I know that today in class we were talking about it, and the whole idea of wanting to be Eleanor, I think it's more that she wants to be like Eleanor and emulate her. It's somebody that she's kind of, Eleanor's older than Anna, about 25. She's put Eleanor up on a pedestal. Now, Eleanor builds a firm friendship with Anna from acceptance, and it's formed through the acceptance of equality, something that Eleanor is, one of her defining qualities is that she doesn't see rank. She doesn't assume that someone is better than somebody else because of rank or gender or social position, which is why Bradford has that reaction at dinner when they're around at Bradford Hall fairly early on in the book. She gives Anna the courage to continue after Anna loses her children and is facing that addiction to the opium as well. The sense of empathy and recognition that she kind of conveys to Anna is that it's going to be hard, but the fact that memories are worth more than the benefits of relying on the opium is something that she impresses upon Anna long enough for Anna to kind of think, okay, even though I'm going to burn these poppy seeds now, I still know where they are in the Gaudi's garden later. So she kind of gives Anna enough temporary courage to kind of get through this little hump that she's going through. Okay, the death of children is not a little hump, but you know what I mean. Eleanor recognises that Anna has talents. Firstly, through the midwifery, when she goes, they go up and they deliver the child, and Anna has to turn the baby because it's breech, and a breech birth means that basically the feet are facing instead of the head to come out through the birth canal. She recognises that Anna has a thirst for knowledge and that she's a brave, courageous person. So the Mary Wickford example again. And she feeds this this knowledge. And it's something that Michael is kind of shocked by. At the end, when Anna translates that untrue in one, untrue in all, from Latin into English, Michael's kind of shocked because Anna's a servant and she's not supposed to know Latin. So when Anna sort of says, yes, well, Eleanor taught me, Michael's quite shocked at that. There's a whole side of their relationship that Michael had no concept about, and it's this very much a feminist kind of getting together, supporting each other. What can we do to kind of help people around us? She embodies the idea of self-sacrifice and benevolence. So if you're not sure what benevolence is, you need to look it up in a dictionary. And what she does as a character is she contrasts the genuine acts of contrition. So she's genuine in what she's doing, and I'm sure, you know, you could argue that Michael's quite genuine as well. But I think that there's an element of hypocrisy in Michael's actions, because he's not necessarily doing it all of this kind of, you know, sermonating, as Perry would say, in front of the class. It's more, in front of the congregation. It's more he's kind of doing it for himself. Whereas Eleanor comes across as being more genuine. She's devoted to her husband, and this does actually show in their public interactions, is that there's a genuine sense of feeling between the two of them. He is distraught when she dies, and his realisation that he couldn't save her creates the crisis that he's undergoing that you see at the beginning of the book and also at the end. The love that she feels for him, you could say, also comes from the idea that she's very grateful for the rescue that he's provided. He's rescued her from an unmarriageable state. He knows exactly what's gone on in her past, and she feels very grateful that he's kind of taken her on despite that, I suppose. So she's grateful that he's saved her. both from social and religious ostracism. Well, if it's not necessarily religious at this point, she's hoping that it will be at some point down the track. She doesn't question Michael's decision to withhold the sexual side of their relationship as a way of atoning for her sin of pregnancy and self-inflicted abortion that we know of. Because obviously there's, with Anna being that subjective first-person narrator, there's a lot that goes on behind the closed doors of the Montpellians that we don't know about. She refers to Anna that this is something that she's willingly signed on for. It's part and parcel of the kind of loving deal, if you were, that she's negotiated with him or accepted. I don't know that there was much in the way of negotiation. But there is regret that comes through when she's telling Anna about it in the Poppies of Leith chapter. You could also say that Eleanor's trapped in a marriage where she cannot express her passion, as Michael believes that this is what's responsible for her previous sin. So he's clamped her down so tightly that she's got no way of actually expressing her passionate nature in both a sexual way and in an emotional kind of way unless it's condoned by him. So when she goes to him and wants that service, she wants him to give that service, and he says no, those frustration, tears that she's crying is partly because there's a recognition there, I think. I mean, feel free to disagree with me. There's a recognition there that it's not a marriage of equals, and she has always got to follow his lead. She's his subordinate. It's not necessarily they're coming at it from equal points of view. She's a kind and generous person. She's not so painfully sweet and one-dimensional that, you know, she kind of gets on your nerves entirely, although that does sort of, you know, I would imagine some people find her a little bit underdeveloped in that respect. It can be argued that she encourages Anna to aim for the kind of life that she can't have herself. And when she says to Anna that you were like a flame blown by the wind until it was almost extinguished, all I had to do was put the glass around you, and now how you shine. And that's on page 235. There's an element of regret there, and not envy, but she's kind of living vicariously through Anna's development as well. Now, just onto the student notes. Before she was Michael's wife, she was kept away from society. Her fall from grace at the hands of the Duke's son is something that would have been scandalous at that time. And again, if you've read Pride and Prejudice, you'll understand that even, say, 200, 300 years later, that sort of thing was still very much regarded as a woman's sin. Now, she was kept sedated during her recovery to keep her calm, although she recognises that life goes on when she says, "How futile it is to wallow in regret for that which cannot be changed, and how atonement might be made for the grievest of sins." So she's recognising that life goes on, and that perhaps the work she's doing in the village is work that's sort of going towards atoning for that horrific sin. She's a product of a patriarchal society. She depends on men around her, and that's possibly one of the reasons that she encourages Anna in her exploration of learning, of teaching her not only how to write, read and write, but also Latin, herbal knowledge. So she's kind of expanding Anna's horizons as well. She's actually quite educated for a woman of the time, and that's quite a rarity. All she had to do, she says, was express a wish, and these treasures would be laid out before me. So that's why she's actually got such a good command of Latin and history and all sorts of other things. But she didn't learn about human nature because, as she says to Anna, she was a very sheltered, cloistered kind of girl. And she was 14 when all of this happened as well. So it was the path that she was on was interrupted, and she ended up taking a very different path than probably she and her father expected her to. She dies in an unexpected way. So the maternal instinct that she demonstrates throughout the novel ends up placing her in the path of harm when she tries to take the knife off Aphra. And it's one of the great ironic tragedies, I think, of the characters and what happens. is that this, she goes up to comfort Aphra, and Aphra, just having lost the plot and she is quite insane, takes her revenge on Eleanor. The idea of the sexual abstinence, Michael holds it over her as a way of paying penance for her sin. So it's, he sees it as a way of, she has to make payment. She's done something horrific, and she has to make payment. This is his one way of seeing that that payment is done, that, you know, it's very personal and very intimate. Because lust causes sin, he says, I deemed that she should atone by living some part of her life with her lusts unrequited, which is on page 281, and we'll get to him and his patriarchal and hypocritically misogynistic attitude. But there you go. She has remarkably a physical kind of construct that means that she's resistant to the plague, and she's... So physically she's quite strong, and also socially she's really quite strong as well. So she chooses not to judge people in the same way that pretty much everyone around her does, or unlike, I should say. So, okay, now I know that from experience some of you are sitting here thinking, oh, is she going to stop talking soon? So I'll give you a little bit of a break, and then I'm going to come back and do Michael, and we'll finish off the main character podcast. Okay, so Michael, we'll start with the insight notes. Right, so he comes across as being a charismatic, persuasive, and not a little arrogant, actually, in this book. He appeals to the villagers' moral virtue with his sermon at the start, and he's a leader and somebody who believes quite thoroughly that he can save the village, that the plague is a test by God, and that the villagers of Eden will survive with their faith intact and purified. So he sees this plague as being some form of crucible, some test that they have to endure, and that they will come out the other end of it and everything will be better than it was before. He does have compassion and moral integrity. I will actually give him that. He is authoritarian, and when the mob is attacking the Gowdies, he actually is unafraid to kind of jump into the middle of the mob and start pulling apart people who are fighting. He remonstrates, so he tells people off that are actually taking advantage of the situation. That seemed to really good effect when he goes up and tries to talk to Anna's father, Joss. Unfortunately, he comes across as being a bit preachy, and Joss is like, basically, take your fancy language and get out. I think he does genuinely believe in what he's saying. I think probably more towards the end, it's almost like he's trying to convince himself of the truth of what he's saying, though. He does provide care and guidance to those who are dying, and he writes their wills, he digs their graves when there's no one else to do it. This is before Joss takes over. And he genuinely does try to look after the people that are left behind. So the writing up of the will, and Brand gets written into the will, if you remember, and the two smaller children are actually kind of looked after as well. You could argue that he's partly motivated by an altruistic need to save the village with quarantine. So an altruistic, you're doing something altruistic, you're doing it because for no personal gain or recognition. You could also argue that he believes that God's testing him personally. And this is perhaps one of the reasons that he falls apart when Eleanor dies, because he's failed and he feels that God's actually abandoned him. And Michael acts as though he knows what's best for Eleanor, which is typical of the time, given, as I said earlier, that it's a patriarchal society. But he also does come across as being unsympathetic and quite judgmental, which is really very much a contrast to Eleanor, who completely lacks judgment and tries to see the good in everyone. When she dies, he can't see any explanation for the divine lack of compassion that he's experiencing. So while he feels that God's actually abandoned him, he can't fathom why God's abandoned him, given that he did everything that he thought God was asking of him. He's quite blinkered in some respects to the outside world around him. Because if you look at how Anna reacts at the end, she's become the smart, strong, independent woman, and he can't see why she reacts so badly to his treatment of Eleanor when he tells her. Though there is a suggestion that perhaps he would change and come to see a little bit more of Anna's viewpoint if she'd stayed, but I think that would be a fairly limited change on his part. Now, I'm going to read the quote that I was given in class. The Sermonator is initially a good bloke. Not the Sperminator, the Sermonator. Now, he was given the nickname the Sermonator in class because he's quite good at what he does, especially that first sermon is awesome. I think the fainting fit later on is probably quite dramatic as well, but he does know how to give a good sermon. Please don't write that in the exam, okay? By the end, he's shown that he's actually a human being and that there's a bad side, that he's got demons, that he's got a dark side, that he's full of flaws and shortcomings as a person. The sermons that he gives as the Sermonator gives him courage, faith and hope. So he is someone that genuinely does try to do that. The voluntary kind of isolation that he, or quarantine that he puts the village into, or convinces them to put themselves into, gives them a sense of unity in a really difficult situation and time. He appeals to people's moral virtues, and even though they've got a wide range of religious convictions and they're quite divided in what they believe, he manages to unify them around a central point of, we need to do this, we need to see this as a test from God, and we will actually, if we stick together, survive this. So he kind of appeals, he goes beyond just religious beliefs into appealing to them as people, which is actually quite important. He's taken Eleanor under his wing. He wants to redeem her, he wants to save her. In a sense, he sees himself as a bit of a Jesus-like figure, that he sees himself as someone who can save, who sacrifices himself for others. And when he says on page 282, I thought I spoke for God, fool. My whole life, all I have done, all I have said, all I have felt has been based upon a lie. So this is the point where he's going through that sort of personal crisis and unsure as to why God's actually abandoned him. He does nurture Anna to a degree, but he's also surprised by her. And I think that's another demonstration of how unaware he was of the kind of impact and influence that Eleanor had on Anna. When Anna knows Latin, as I said earlier, on page 267, he's surprised, but he's not entirely pleased that she knows stuff that he thinks that a woman really shouldn't know. He pushes himself to extremes. He risks himself, his life and his health when he comes into contact with the people that are dying by digging the graves. And this is shown really quite well when he collapses giving that sermon and then Mr. Stanley has to get up and kind of rouse them all and tell them what they're doing next. He's so fully committed to the action that they're undertaking that he fails to see himself as being human, subject to human limits. It's almost like he's taken on this evangelical zeal and is just going for it. He uses religion as an excuse, perhaps, to behave in the way that he does to his wife. So he uses the religious argument to justify his treatment of Eleanor, which is just reprehensible, I think. The actions of others who violate the rules he has set reminds him of Eleanor's actions, but he ignores them. So when he tells the dying man, I can't remember his name, but when he tells the dying man that, don't worry about it, your wife's forgiven, she's in heaven, I'm sure you didn't mean to. And then later on he turns around and Anna's like, yeah, but you, this is what you said. And he's like, do you honestly think that I believe that? So he's saying one thing and actually kind of believing something privately that's quite different. He doesn't judge others in his parish, but he's so willfully judgmental of Eleanor, even after he and Anna have become intimate. He can't let that go. He can't let go the fact that Eleanor did something really terrible. He thinks that he's superior to Eleanor, that it's her sin and something that she must be purified for. And again, it comes back to that patriarchal society that they were living in. The sin that was committed
was her fault because she was the woman. She was the one that got pregnant. Not the guy that seduced her, but she, the 14-year-old, innocent, cloistered little child, essentially, she's the one that he needs to redeem. He constantly disrespects her because the ongoing sexual omission in their relationship as a way of punishing her demonstrates that he doesn't fully accept her as a person. And he sees the full measure of this and how God has actually abandoned him at the end when he drops the Bible and he passes on that message, untrue in one thing, untrue in everything. So for him, by that stage, there's nothing that he believes in and that he knows that he can actually sort of buy into. He doesn't realize, as I said earlier, how close Anna and Eleanor actually were, but it's actually too late for him to do anything about it. He doesn't know how much his wife has told Anna about the relationship, so he leaves himself vulnerable to her judgment in the same way that he's judged his wife. And he tries to avoid the guilt of what he's done. At the end, he feels as though he's let God down, that he's being punished for his actions and perhaps has been abandoned for his own arrogance and assuming that he could save Eleanor in the village. Well, we could only hope, really. I don't know. I think perhaps he's feeling as though God's abandoned him because he didn't take the right path and doing what he was supposed to with the village, and perhaps Eleanor is his own personal punishment for doing that. But he certainly comes to a greater understanding of his behaviour by the end of the novel. Okay, now it's 37 minutes long. I was going to put a few new notes at the end of this podcast, but I will throw that into, I think, the themes podcast instead, because there are quite a few more general notes as well that I was going to include, so they're probably better suited in that one. Okay, now if you're after a copy of the notes, you're not sure about the things that I'm referencing, you can always email me and ask me for a copy of them. So I will see you next time.